Blog Talk Radio.
Up to 2012, there must be books upon your shelf. Information you can get World Wide Web. Don't follow those leaders who watch this parking meter.
Welcome to YowRadio.com, sponsored by Your Own World Books, publishers of Crossing the Cusp, Planet X Forecast and 2012 Survival Guide, and the Colburn Bible. So join us now by raising your mind to the open and locked position and buckle up for the ride. You're on Yow Radio. Well, hey there, Yowza subscribers and listeners at large. Well, tonight, we just got a full slate on the show. And we have got, first off, a little bit of a surprise for y'all. Ed is going to come on and give us a quick Comet Elenin update. Now, for me, folks, it's let's just sit and see what we see time. Because I think all of the forecasting and all the estimating that you could do has already been done. And I will say one thing for Ed, is that Ed was the principal lead on the Comet Elenin research team, and he did most of the work, the research work, on the timeline. And Ed said on the 26th we would have solar activity, interaction between Elenin and the sun that would affect us, and that is exactly what happened. And also, if you remember back that time, the solar storms were enough that was kicking space junk out of the sky. We had that huge bus-sized satellite that deorbited because it was getting pushed down. The magnetosphere of our planet is getting weaker, and solar storms are more easily can buffet things and create a problem for them. And so I'm going to bring on our two guests right out the gate, and I'm going to have Ed and John come on. And Ed, welcome back.
Hello, sir.
Hey, good to have you here. And John, are you there?
Hello, Marshall.
Hey, all right. Dynamic duo. Okay, Ed. Well, yeah, I think you really nailed it, Ed, with the 26th. We had a solar event. Knock on wood. Did you hear me knocking on wood, someone? Okay.
I thought that was my head.
Oh, no, Pinocchio. Oh, you're going to get me started here, Ed. But as I said in the open, you really had it on the 26th, and it was just a matter of it not being as severe. But I remember that day very quickly. I mean, we were doing a show here, and I had been out in the afternoon, and we had felt that hot sun on the face, and a lot of other people reported it. We saw a bolide that evening. And that really kicks into this broader pattern of what I'm seeing in the email box about more concerns over more comets coming in and impactors. There's a rash of new comets that are being reported now on the IAU, Central Bureau for Astronomical Telegrams. And there's just a huge list. And, I mean, their list does not include the ones that are SOHO captures doing a death dive into the sun. So with that, Ed, what's the latest and greatest you're seeing on the Elenin story?
Well, first to mention, we did have, a 3 or 4 day solar storm that did sort of show that there was an electrical charge attached with this comet.
Mm-hmm.
I think I viewed it on the HI-1 satellite.
Mm-hmm.
It appears it's very faint now, but it appears it's picked up some speed. It's actually worked itself to where it's not visible on the satellite anymore.
Mm-hmm.
as it's curving around the sun now, and
yeah, well,
working to where it's going to cross our orbit.
Right. Right, and that's, you know, we're looking in the time coming ahead here. So, and of course, with November passing through the tail of the residual. So you are getting imagery that is showing the nucleus is still intact?
It looks intact. It's not got a very high magnitude, which I believe when we had the electrical interaction here between the sun, us, and the moon, and the comet, I think it discharged a lot of the juice out of it. And we have the, how you say, perihelion for us. As close as we're going to get with that comet is going to be about the 17th of this month. And
okay.
Originally we thought that was a big danger time. I'm not quite so sure about that at the moment, due to the fact that it looks like it's lost a lot of its charge.
Okay.
But I still am very worried about the November danger zone that we warned everyone about from November 2nd through the 6th as we cross its orbital path with the possible collision dangers that come with it.
Okay.
And then November 2nd when we're between it and the sun, that still might be quite a problem for us if it picks up some more juice.
Well, you know, the question I have in my mind, is there possibility that there's a last gasp left in this thing? That it could, say, between now and November, there could be another CME that slams it, and this time it just pops. It outbursts suddenly, and all of a sudden, we got a bright star in the sky.
Well, that's extremely possible. I think those of us that have been watching noticed how the solar activity increased as the comet sort of came into the game. And as it neared perihelion and such, our solar activity just dramatically increased. We had the X flare and some M. We virtually almost lived in the M flare neighborhood for a long time.
Yeah.
Which is why we go out in the sun and it would burn the doggone heck out of you.
Yeah.
If you were out in it for 5 minutes. And
yeah.
We were getting high doses of radiation.
We were, you know, and I was listening to a Coast to Coast, and Nuri was going on about, you know, how people were, it made people kind of giddy about things. And
that is another effect of the magnetism and the electromagnetism. There's a lot of behavioral studies, especially by the Russians, who are way ahead of us in magnetics, about behavioral sciences with magnetics affecting our brain.
So, I mean, as we look out here, take us through week by week, third week, fourth week of October, first and second week of November. If you're going to crystal ball, and let me notify the viewers or listeners, this is a speculation. Whoop, whoop, whoop. Okay, there you go. You got your caveat.
Absolutely.
Go for it, Ed.
This is a big maybe.
Big maybe
here. Well, we know we're going to be as close as we're going to get to it right around a week from now.
Okay.
It's always possible we can have another electrical or geomagnetic interaction. I don't personally look for it, but it's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
We always stand the possibility from now until, oh boy, probably the end of the year, that it could kick up solar activity in a heartbeat.
Okay.
With another geoelectrical connection. As it's picked up speed and it's going like heck now, it's going to pick up more charge again. And it does appear to be getting brighter.
And does this comet appear to have surrounding gravitationally captured bodies? Other comets,
you know,
and asteroids that would be crashing into the sun, exciting the sun also?
You know, that's another thing that is really strange about all of this is as we've gone years and years with very few comets, and now all of a sudden we're being inundated with them. And that might be another story for another show about what might be causing that.
Yeah, Marshall, I think, was saying that this Elenin may be big enough to be carrying, dragging with it other asteroids and smaller comets that would be exciting the sun also as they get grazed
well,
the sun and crash into it.
When it was in its early stages and it was photographed, especially radio photographed with the radio scopes, it showed, because they looked through the dust and all, it did show a lot of garbage around it and some very large objects. So, yeah, it's got a lot of trash with it. Right now it doesn't have much of a tail at all.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't indicate that it doesn't have garbage following it. It just means that it's not throwing off a tail due to an ice or a gaseous discharge. The tail, if there's garbage behind it, it doesn't mean it's going to illuminate. So, yeah, we could be in for some hot times here around the first week of November. In the meanwhile, we've been seeing all kinds of bolides, and it's almost like it brought a dirty part of space with it.
Yeah.
Ed, is there a location, a clearinghouse of information that would give us a daily report on the bolide sighted? Bolide objects sighted, something like USGS gives us a daily report on earthquakes?
You know, I'm not aware of one, John, at this point in time. Somebody else might know of one. I wish I did. It'd be easier for me to do some research.
Yeah, well, I guess the Internet and Google are our best hope for that right now.
Absolutely.
How many hits
and
do you
people
get
reporting
on the word,
it, you know?
Meteorite, you know? On any given day, if you get 500,000 hits on the word meteorite on a given day as compared to 250,000 hits on another day, then you have a general idea as to how.
Well, we do have the Near Earth Object website. I'm not sure if it's JPL or NASA that sponsors it.
Mm-hmm.
And it does talk about and tell us about a lot of asteroids and such, which, you know, was made classified from us a couple years ago. We weren't allowed to know about those anymore,
yeah.
Unless they tell us about them. And
so
that's about the closest thing I can think of right now.
Yeah, I mean, I would advise people listening, because we do need a lot of people helping out here and gathering information, to go to Google every day and just type in the word meteorite or some other similar terms into it, and at Google Advanced Search, selecting a particular day. Like, you can choose a date of articles that are sourced from Google. You could say, in the past 24 hours, only those reports that occurred then, or in the past week, whatever. And if somebody could plot that on a chart, we could find out day by day, week by week, how many Google hits, and pardon the pun, hits we're getting on meteorites.
Yes, and because we know that the news only half of the time reports it locally. Unless it's a major, major event, then it gets the national news, but that's not very often.
Yes, yeah, so we're really flying on our own here.
Yeah,
we're
flying blind.
We're
because
flying blind.
NASA, when they classified the telescopes and all that were showing us everything that was close, well, they took our eyes away. And
there's a piece of evidence right there that they are deliberately covering up the incoming celestial bodies, the fact
yes.
that many of them are coming into our solar system. I mean, you know, as Marshall said, it's not the crime that really incriminates them. It's the cover-up that incriminates
yes.
them.
The thing I worry about most is I worry about them increasing and such, but what I worry about most is why are they increasing? What is
why
causing this to happen?
Oh, Well, you have, okay, now Planet X is surrounded by many, many thousands, perhaps millions of gravitationally captured objects.
Mm-hmm.
Bingo.
And I mean, and even that Kachina, the Blue Kachina, which is could be, if it's of major size, it will have its own gravitationally captured field of objects, you know, many millions of miles in diameter. And that's the whole reason. This is like a huge, this is a drive-by shotgun blast, a flyby.
You know, I wanted to mention, thank you, John, but I forgot to mention the possibility that this comet still could very possibly become a Kachina.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, I don't know the size of it because I haven't been following it.
Well, they said it was approximately 3 to 5 kilometers in diameter. And
now,
I wonder, because it's not thrown off a tail, whether or not it would be possible for it to turn into a Blue Kachina. But with an electrical charge, and we already know that it does charge, to me it always holds that possibility that it could go poof like that other comet did and put on a great show for us.
Well, here's what happens when the comet punctures the outer heliosphere surrounding the solar system. That comet will pick up lots of electrically sticky plasma. That's positive, electrically charged protons that comprise the outer heliosphere, like that glowing red globe that surrounds the solar system. But when it comes into the comes deeper into the solar system toward the sun, it'll first pull a tail along with it because it's way, way out there, and the positively charged protons have not had a chance to catch up with the comet. But as the comet approaches the sun, which is largely negative, it has an electron space charge around it, then the electrically negative attractive forces pulling on these positive protons on the tail of the comet cause the tail to spring forward and engulf the nucleus. And then that's what causes the comet to change from something with a long, wiggly tail, as the Chinese had viewed many centuries ago, something with a long, wiggly tail or a long, straight tail, to something that's just glowing and very much larger with a glowing coma around it. It's closer proximity to the sun. And then eventually, if the comet gets close enough to the sun, like this comet just did, it'll discharge because, you have a highly negative negative electron space charge surrounding the sun. And as this positively charged plasma of the comet gets closer to the sun, you have a spike of electricity and discharge, just like when your fingers or your hand gets zapped when you walk across a carpet and touch a heavy metal object. And that's why
I think
it lost
that's,
the glow.
I think that's exactly almost describing everything that this comet has done.
Yeah, because it's basic electricity and magnetism principles.
It did magnify in its glow and its magnitude and size, and then it obviously discharged. We had an X-class and just a whole handful of M-class flares. And then a 3 or 4 day geomagnetic storm, which is just a little bit long. And Marshall and I had spoke about it at one point behind the scenes, but we wondered if possibly our moon saved us.
Yeah, I mean, if the moon is blocking, is acting as a barrier, then we will not get most of that discharge from the comet.
Yeah, we had a supermoon that time.
But
so,
this is, when the comet discharges into the sun, like as it appeared to have done, of course it loses its plasma, its positive electrically charged plasma surrounding it, and it consequently loses its glow. And that's what you noticed. But then again, in discharging to the sun, it caused the sun to react and flare out with even greater solar flares. And perhaps if that's probably not that much, not too much in the way of particles, but still a lot of solar winds were thrown off with the flare. And with the coronal mass ejection, I think we had some CMEs recently. You get a tremendous amount of solar winds, which are protons and electrons. So now the comet gets re-engulfed, resaturated with these protons, and it picks up, begins to glow again.
That's right.
Yeah, and that was exactly what happened with the solar wind just increased suddenly and stayed 600 to 700 kilometers a second for 3 to 4 days, right along with the geomagnetic storm, of course. And we did not have a coronal hole facing us at that time. I mean, just everything that evidence-wise points to the fact that we did have a large electrical interaction between the comet and the sun, and then the comet, us, and the sun and our moon. And we see, as it has pulled out of the inferior conjunction, that now things are starting to calm down. Because our baseline X-rays had come up to almost M-class just as a baseline. And then as the comet hit the conjunction and moved away now, our baseline has gone back down into the B-class. And you go out in the sun, it doesn't cook you like it did.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what else you're going to see. Now, you're already seeing this. Somebody sent some SOHO pictures recently. And you could see what looked like these tiny little glowing flying saucers approaching the sun. And what they really, really are winged globes. And this relates to the phenomenon that you can expect, the phenomenon that you can expect to see with this comet as it gets closer to the sun. And this has happened historically. In ancient history, there have been reports of this when the Planet X came in the last time. And that is, the sun gets so excited by this interacting discharge between the approaching comet and the sun their solar winds are blown out and coronal mass ejections are blown out furiously from the sun, and they begin to engulf the comet, the approaching flirting comet, and then the solar winds spread out laterally, wings of plasma that stream outward laterally from both sides of the comet. This is what the ancients saw. This is what passed over ancient Egypt before the Israelites were liberated from Pharaoh's bondage. They noticed this winged globe, and that was the destroyer referred to in Exodus, the book of Exodus, chapter 12. So you're going to see winged globes. Look at the SOHO pictures whenever you can, Ed, and see if you see these little tiny glowing flying saucers. And that's the winged globe effect. I don't think anybody has really put that together yet.
I've seen those many times. I do monitor the SOHO a lot with the LASCO satellites. And, yes, I've seen those winged objects many times.
And that's the effect we can expect. So we know this is a basic electrical phenomena that occurs with this flirtation between the comet and the sun. So we can expect to see that as this comet comes closer to the sun. We could expect to see a winged globe. And Zechariah Sitchin describes it, relates the ancient texts of the Ninevites and the Assyrian Babylonian astronomers, who described this winged globe. And the winged globe was a famous, worshipped symbol throughout the civilizations of the ancient civilizations. This winged globe could be found in palaces and on cylinder seals, and we could, you know, archaeologists have found it to be essentially universal throughout the ancient world. In fact, even today, the winged globe is the symbol of the United States Air Force. The winged globe is also the Chrysler Corporation's insignia.
Good point.
So
now this insignia also is in South America, not only in the Middle East, correct?
You're probably right. I mean, maybe you could fill me in on that. I know the Thunderbird. You know the Native Americans Thunderbird?
Uh-huh.
They saw comets in the sky that actually had the wings, and then there was a discharge. As the comet got close enough to Earth, there was a vertical discharge of plasma because the comet is much more positively charged than the Earth is. So naturally, you're going to have a discharge between two relatively oppositely charged bodies. And that discharge to the ground caused a cross, the sign of a cross, or what the Indians saw as a thunderbird.
Interesting.
Ooh. So, gentlemen, it's
so well, gentlemen, see that. The reason we're talking about it, because it's going to happen again.
I have to concur with that. Well, I'm going to have to run here shortly, gentlemen.
Yeah, I know. You got
let's
a family
hope that,
thing,
too. And, well, let's hope that we're incorrect with all of my maybes, and that we've had our turn with this comet, and we'll wait and see what comes up next.
Yeah, that's where it's at. In the meantime, enjoy your family soiree. Have a good get-together.
Thank you,
here.
Sir.
Thanks,
thank
Ed.
You, and
thank
good
you,
talking
Ed.
With you, John.
My pleasure.
Talk to you guys. Have a good show, guys.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Hey, all right. So, John, we were getting into the, and it was really interesting what you were talking about with the ancient Egyptians had seen. I mean, this is also documented in the Colburn Bible. You know, they're talking about the destroyer, and I mean, the way the Egyptians talk about it is, it just was created a lot of fear and a lot of damage. It was a global disaster, no question about it. And it's also called, you know, as I've said so many times before, it's interesting that both the Hebrews, ancient Hebrews, and the ancient Egyptians used the same exact term to describe the destroyer. And we're seeing a lot of these other signs. And so, John, I think that, talking about Planet X, and this really for me is a good chance to kind of, you know, Elenin has really, for the last few months, dominated the dialogue. And not only has it dominated the dialogue, but the disinformation was just hyping this story so insanely and just causing a lot of needless worry and panic. I'm not saying there's nothing here not to be concerned with, but I could definitely see that mechanism. But the interesting thing, and I want to ask your opinion on this, John, and I'd like to get Bill come on in and step in for this too, because I'd like to give this question to both of you guys. With everything that's coming on right now, all right, we have more comets being reported. It's interesting to see all these comets hitting into the sun. But we also have a lot of them that are in general areas that are being discovered, so there's more of them. We have the Kachinas. We have people that are starting to send in two sun-in-the-sky images. Now, and we're evaluating them. I think that an important thing that I am seeing right now in the topic and is the shift in the disinformation. Now, I use disinformation as a research tool. For other people, it's an annoyance, it's inconvenience, it leaves them down, you know, pointless rabbit holes, and they get exhausted and walk away from the topic, which is exactly the goal of the disinformationalist. They're not trying to sell you on a lie, they're just trying to create so much utter miserable confusion that people just go, oh, to hell with it, and they just throw their hands up in the air and walk off. And they have been amazingly successful with this, as I saw that they did, but not as successful as I've seen their campaigns in the past. Now, that's an interesting thing. In the past, they could kill the interest in a topic, artificially hype it up, and so that it just take out the energy and the wave collapses, and then that's it. The wave just is never going to regenerate. Not so with the Comet Elenin story. Instead of the wave crashing and all interest going away, there's still a core audience of people out there that are following it. And they're antsy. They want to know information about it. Meanwhile, we have these two sun in the sky photos that are, in my opinion, a huge difference is that no longer they're the disinformation plants that I have seen on YouTube and elsewhere since, I would say, late 2008, going in perhaps even as early as maybe late 2007, but definitely in 2008 we were seeing the cell phone sundog photos. And, you know, we were doing analysis on this. It was very clearly, when you look at the modus operandi and how they do it, these were paid disinformationalists, and their whole goal was to desensitize people to two suns in the sky photos. That was the whole goal, and they were largely successful, because now what we're starting to see for the first time, especially in the last few months, is what I call genuine reports, which is not an authentic report. Genuine means it's just an honest person having an honest experience, and they're honestly trying to figure out what in the hell they're looking at. But, okay, you have an authenticated observation. Now, that's it. You know, for Planet X Research, that's the holy grail. It's X marks the spot, pin the tail on the donkey. It's the big ugly rock, and someone has seen it. But what I have seen, though, is that the disinformationalists are changing their tactics. They're no longer injecting this stuff. What they're doing is going back to their plan A, which is debunking whatever's in, and then using all of this desensitized zeitgeist out there, and all they have to do is repeat the magical words three times. Sundog, sundog, sundog. You know, I mean, it's like a scene right out of Karate Kid, right? And, you know, wax on, wax off. But they're doing that. They're shifting their gears now to debunk the genuine reports. Tell me something. Both of you guys, I want to start first with Bill. When do you think this is actually going to materialize to a point where we have more a genuine two-sun sighting that is then authenticated? In other words, they're seeing something that's real and it's never been cataloged.
Well, you know, We're almost seeing that now with some of the reports that are coming in, Marshall. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of these images and videotapes and whatnot are so hard to debunk. It's almost impossible for them to debunk it. I give you the news report out of China.
Mm-hmm.
The two sun sunrise. And they reported that all over China and all over the world. I mean, there's two suns right there, and they reported it on the news.
Bingo.
People have seen it on the webcams, from the Antarctica.
That's right.
You know, and those, technically you could write them off as sundogs because it's a webcam and it's a teeny tiny little lens and everything, but there are some oddities that we've seen on those. And we're seeing more and more of this type of imaging coming in. And as people are picking up on it, they're developing their own techniques and everything for taking a look at this and shooting the photos and the images and everything else, and we're starting to see those propagate on the internet. And it's going to be real hard for these people to debunk it because they're not posting it on the usual conspiracy websites.
That's right.
They're going right out in the mainstream.
They're going out into mainstream. And here's the point where, for the listeners out there, we've started up a new site called twosunsinthesky.com. Just spell it out, twosunsinthesky.com. It's a WordPress blog, but what we're really doing is creating a research portal, if you will, a place where folks that are making two sun sightings can actually go in and, you know, get some help on it, because I think for anyone that's making a genuine observation, they have so many artificial barriers. First off, there's the knee-jerk response that's been programmed into the public with just this years of, you know, very methodical battle of attrition on the whole credibility of the topic with, you know, these cheesy sundog photos by disinformationalists. They've got to overcome that knee-jerk response. Then once you get past that, then you have the regular cynical response. And it's even tougher because people just don't look up that often. You know, it's like, did either of you guys ever see the movie Avatar?
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay.
I haven't watched it. I haven't seen it either.
Well, there is one, you know, the key phrase is, Taruk Makto. And so this guy has got to go, there's this big flying creature, and he's the biggest bad guy on the planet. And wherever he goes, everything runs like crazy from him. And he decides he's going to take and ride him to become a superhero. And so what he does is he takes his little beastie and he flies over him and jumps down. And as he's jumping down, you know, he's narrating it and saying, well, this guy's the biggest guy on the block. He doesn't have to look up. So I'm going to drop on him from above. And that's the theory. And his theory paid out. And, you know, I see that scene in that movie and it makes me think about what's happening with folks. And we get all these questions. It's like, how often are people looking up and seeing this stuff? So, you know, what's your thought on that, John?
Well, Marshall, let's pretend that my eyes are on planet Earth. And,
okay.
You know, we're creating a mini solar system here. And I'm looking out my bedroom window right now, and there's a street light about 70 feet out in front of my house.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say that that street light is the second sun, or that mysterious object. And now I take an orange and I hold it in my outstretched hand right in my line of sight. And that orange represents the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So if I were to look at it, I could fool myself into thinking, wow, that orange is right next to the street light, where, in fact, I'm looking 70 feet out my front window at that street light, and the orange is about 2 feet in front of my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So we need an astronomer to tell us, okay, it looks like there's two suns, but what is our depth perception? We need astronomers to tell us, how far out is it, really close to the sun or not? Well, we can find that out from good astronomers, even maybe amateur astronomers. But also, think about what an object would do if it were close to the sun. It would cause all kinds of excitations electrically. It could cause disastrous excitations that would destroy the Earth if the object
mm-hmm.
was large enough. So if we see two suns and the sun is really not really acting up very much, we can sort of sense by rule of thumb that second object is in the line of sight of the sun, but it's way out there. Now, another thing is we can use basic geometry. Now remember, we're revolving, so I'm on Earth. My eyes are Earth, so if I were to walk in a circle, begin to walk to the side in my bedroom as I'm looking at that streetlight, but I still hold the orange in my hand, now the streetlight would seem to move, shift away by a particular distance or angle arc. And that could tell me, using basic geometry, We know how far the Earth moved, so we have essentially one side of an arc or a triangle, one side of a triangle. And we know how far we are from the sun, and maybe we can use some basic geometry to figure out how far out is that second object. So there's three ways you could determine how close to the sun this object really is. One with good professional or very good amateur astronomers. Another is with watching solar excitations. And the third is maybe some basic geometry.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing that's interesting for me, and we've been looking at two suns' images, and the grabber for me is, and the reason why Bill Zam and I decided to launch Two Suns in the Sky, and you're also going to help participate in that project too, and I really appreciate you stepping up. And also for those of you out there that, you know, are interested in offering something, and I'm not talking about, we don't need people with comments like, oh, cool, and stuff like that, or you're a bunch of dorkwads, or whatever they're going to do. It's, you know, comments that are talking to the science of what we're trying to do. Because I really, my heart goes out to the people that are seeing this, because I have seen, it really affects them profoundly. And in a way that to me is very similar of when I have seen people talk about their UFO abductions or being implanted, all right? And when people are making a presentation like that and they know that people are going to be cynical and think that they're nuts and pulling it out of their tuchus, but they know what happened. They feel it. They live with it. It's a miserable place to be for those people. And what I'm seeing is the same thing is really happening to the folks that are starting to make these genuine reports. They're timid, they're cowed by, you know, dealing with all of this heavy skepticism that they've got to wade through. And so more than anything else, even before we get to the point where we say we have an aha picture, you know, we've seen it, at which point, you know, you probably wind up losing your website. But until then, it's just really helping people to do this. Now, when I wrote Crossing the Cusp, Surviving Edgar Cayce Pole Shift, I spent the first third of that book completely analyzing and decoding the Avebury 2008 formation. Now, what I will say is, on one hand, I want to do Two Suns in the Sky to give moral support and also to help people to understand what they're seeing so they don't wind up being like UFO abductees and just living in some sort of pseudo-cynical hell. I want them to feel that there's someone that really cares about what they've experienced and wants to help them understand it. But on the other hand, what I will say is that the Avebury 2008 formation is very clear about the direction of travel and where Planet X should be at this time. And what that formation says when it's decoded is that it's behind the sun. All right, it's not on our side of the sun. And it won't be on our side of the sun until it reaches its point of perihelion. And because of the inclination of the orbit, that it comes in wide and goes out tight. In other words, it comes out some, you know, when it's entering in right now, I mean, it's way out there by the gas giants and beyond. Whereas when it reaches its point of perihelion, closest point to the sun, it's going to be on our side of the sun and above. And at that point, then it exits out the system between Mars and Jupiter. Now, here's a couple of interesting tidbits along the way. There are other sources, and I think that there, you know, Dean is one. Bob Dean, and I think that gentleman is, I've spoken with him personally, and I really love his integrity. he's been working with his research groups, and what they've said is that, you know, when it's at perihelion, it'll be on our side of the sun. Now, he told me this a year before I even started writing Crossing the Cusp, or had even decoded Ave Berry 2008. So the other thing about it is that what the Ave Berry formation says is it's cutting, if you think about it, it's kind of cutting an angle. So Planet X is way out there, and I have to say Nancy Leader has been beating the drum about it, being on the other side of the sun. And, oh, God, that's going to bring mail.
He's been saying it's close to the sun, which is
close
erroneous.
To the sun. It's erroneous, and yeah. So, I mean, I agree it would probably be on the opposite side of the sun. And it arcs over, and really what it's doing is that around, because we're going to see it, according to Ave Berry 2008, in the early part of December 2012, not on the solstice, so don't start sending me emails about Kellerman and his whatever dates. This is, you know, in a waning moon, first couple of weeks of December, and at that point it reaches its point of perihelion. And this is where, if we're standing where that crop circle formed in Ave Berry, you look 45 degrees to your right, 45 degrees up, there it is. So if that's where it happens in December, and we are where we are here, and people are starting to see two sun images where the second object is very small relative to the sun, but it's what we're finding is the genuine reports, all right? Where, and there's problems with a lot of these genuine reports. They're shooting through glass, or they're, you know, there's other mistakes that they're making. But it tends to be to the left side of the sun. So with that whole scenario thrown out, what is the possibility that on this orbit around the sun, we are seeing PX way out there, but it's going to be difficult because it's on the opposite side of the sun, so we get a peak here and we get a peak there. But in time, we're going to see it above our heads, way high in the northern sky. And then, you know, we rotate, you know, we come around full circle, and a year from now, a little bit more than a year from now, it's 14 months from now, we do get to a point where we see it to the right, 45 degrees to the right, 45 degrees up, whereas today we're seeing it just to the left of the sun. Okay, guys, does that make sense to you? First, Bill.
Well, that makes perfect sense to me. I mean,
okay.
It appears, I've read what you've written about it, and I've looked at that crop circle,
mm-hmm.
and I've watched all of your videos, being the loyal co-host and producer that I am.
Yes,
it's the logical position for it to be if it is Planet X, and it certainly appears to me to peak out a little bit, and then it goes back behind the sun and peaks out, and I think that is because of the wobble induced in the Earth's axis by the Japanese and the the Chile earthquakes? Maybe because we had that little wobble in the Earth now. So, you know, the Earth goes on its little wobble there, and it kind of peaks out, and the Earth tips back, and then it goes back behind the sun. But it appears to me at this point that we're seeing it more often than less often. So either it's starting to come around from behind the sun from our viewpoint, or the wobble is more consistent. Does that make sense?
Well, let's take that question and treat it like a hot potato. Yo, John, it's in your lap.
Well, okay, let's go back to that same picture that vision that I created. I'm holding an orange. I'm looking out my bedroom window at the streetlight, 70 feet out from my window. And I'm holding an orange in my hand, outstretched arm. The orange represents the sun, the light streetlight represents Planet X or some large comet. We don't know how far out it is. All we know is it's in my line of sight, and it appears to be right next to the sun. My head is, and my eyes are planet Earth. The orange is the sun, and this distant streetlight is this unknown object, bright object,
mm-hmm.
that appears to be near the sun. Now, Earth is rotating, so I'm Earth. What I'm doing is turning around now, and I'm actually, my arm, well, the sun stays where it's at. My arm is stretched out. Now I have to keep my arm stretched out toward my back, which is causing me a lot of pain. And I'm turning my head around away from the window, but my outstretched arm is still pointed out toward that streetlight. So, I'm sorry, I'm doing it the wrong way. My head, I'm actually rotating sideways because Earth revolves around the sun. So in 6 months, I'm sorry, no, I had it wrong. In 6 months, my back is to the window. My arm is still stretched out, and I'm looking at the orange facing inward toward my inside of my house, away from the window. Can you visualize that? My back is facing the window. The object that we're seeing is to my back. It's dark back there because the sun is no longer there, so I'm looking at the night sky. I should be seeing that object in the night sky now. Do you know what I'm saying? So in 6 months, every 6 months, the Earth rotates or revolves around to the other side of the sun. So do we see this, an arc of distance, a movement of this object next to the sun? Do we see an arc equal to about, what is it, 1/12th of every month, 1/12th to 360 degrees, or about, say, 30 degrees distance every month? That would tell us that this object is way out there, and because it's way out there, its perceived motion is very slight. And the real perceived motion distance, the real perceived separation is between us, the Earth, and the sun, or between my head and that orange. So we can tell again by the movement, the amount of movement, the separation of this object, its apparent separation from the sun per unit time, per week, per month, or whatever, and get a pretty good idea as to how far out it is. Again, we would see major solar excitations, and which would probably could possibly, you know, destroy the Earth. If that object were very close to the sun, you would see discharges, as you point out in your book, sprites of electricity, electric lightning bolts discharging to the sun from this very large object. So, but we're not really seeing that. We're seeing Elenin now. What we're talking about is something other than Elenin, right? This two sun thing.
Right.
I mean, clear in my mind.
Well, I mean, Elenin is not. If anything, I mean, Elenin. Well, we have the analogy of blue Katrina, red Katrina, but I mean, right now, I mean, the Elenin story is going to play out however it's going to play out. I mean, it's, frankly, whatever's going to happen is going to happen out there. You know, we can sit here and ruminate all we want.
But this second sun is not Elenin, right?
Not Elenin. This second sun is not at all. This is something that is really starting to... We're seeing folks that are taking very honest people. I mean, we've been contacting these people, talking with them, what they're seeing, what they're experiencing. In some cases, we're finding that we cannot authenticate what they're submitting to us because, in one case, the woman was shooting through a window. And particularly with double pane, triple pane windows, and they're gas filled in between the panes, they can cause anomalies. Another thing is that when people are shooting the videos, they're typically with these little cheap cameras that are in cell phones, and they hanging, you know, they just stick their hand out the window of the car and they're shooting it going, looky what I saw, looky what I saw, instead of just pulling off to the side of the road and saying, here we are, this is what we're seeing, and taking the time to do it right. But still the same, though, we're seeing people that are seeing something. And what's different for me, because I've been getting these reports from people for years, all right, since 2007 and late 2007. But the difference now is it's always been either disinformation or oddity or curiosity. What I find curiously different now is that the people who are reporting these sightings are good, average, everyday people, and they're emotionally upset by what they've seen. That, for me, is the new twist in the game. But what I gather from what you're saying is that whatever this object is, it's our problem in seeing it consistently from one day to the next is due to the Earth's wobble. And because it's not moving dramatically across the sky, that would indicate that it's at some considerable distance away.
Well, and don't forget it's also being hidden by the glare of the sun, too.
That's right. That's right.
That's another big issue that people are having. But I think, Marshall, if we describe exactly what this thing looks like and where it appears relative to the disk of the sun, you know, I think most of them look like they're coming in at around 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, if you're looking at it, you know, if the sun is the face of a clock, between 10 and 11 o'clock, I think. And most of the time, if the sun is partially occluded by clouds, or if you're talking about a sunset or a sunrise situation where the sun is really going through a lot of the atmosphere so that the sun is dimmed out more so you can look straight at the sun with your eyes, that's when more people are more inclined to see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that.
And it basically looks like, if you imagine what Jupiter looks like from a telescope, if you've seen pictures of Jupiter through a telescope, it basically looks like that, just right next to the sun.
Yeah, it looks like that. I mean, it's like
that's a good example.
And everybody always says
something far away that could look like it's close to the sun because it's in your line of sight. But you know, Marshall, think about this now. You go back to that visualization, the visual image of we are Earth and we're looking at this orange, which is the sun. Now, you know that if I'm looking at the orange out the window, the only time I could see this distant object is in the daytime.
Right.
Because when it's nighttime, my head is turned around the other way. I'm looking out into the dark sky. I can see it in the daytime if the object is on the opposite side of the sun from us. But in 6 months, that object is going to be on the same side of the sun. We're going to be on the same side of the sun as that distant object is. So what do we have to do to see it? We have to look out into the night sky. When it's nighttime, we look out into the dark sky and we should see it 6 months from now. That's assuming that right today, and that's just an assumption, today that this object is on the direct opposite side of the sun from us. So 6 months from today, we could look into the night, turn around, we'll look into the night sky, and we should be able to see it. And that would answer all of our questions. In fact, you don't even have to wait 6 months. You could wait until a quarter of a revolution, 3 months from now, a quarter of the Earth's revolution around the sun. You'll be able to see it in the twilight.
Yeah.
Or at sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you're sideways to it, right?
Right.
And the sun will no longer be blocking it, even 3 months from now. If you look at it, sundown or sunrise, the sun will no longer be blocking this object. So what were they seeing 6 months ago when they thought they saw two suns in the sky? I mean, 6 months ago, it's either on one side or either on the same side of the sun from us or on the opposite side, depending on which 6 months you're talking about.
That's right.
So it makes you wonder, what were they talking about 6 months ago? It can't be the same thing that we're seeing today because the Earth has gone halfway around the sun.
But wouldn't the orbital dynamics, if the thing is if the thing is in some type of an orbit, say, you know, almost directly opposite to us, if we're going around the sun and that's going around the sun?
Oh, it wouldn't be in orbit. It wouldn't be. It would be if it's Planet X. It's coming. It's the crossing. The planet of the crossing. It crosses over our orbital path. It's an incoming intruder, like sort of like you're running a race. You know, you see the racetrack. These runners with a track within a track. There's inner tracks and outer tracks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are the planets revolving around the sun. And maybe some of the judges in the center would be at the center. They represent the sun of all these tracks. And then some spectator comes dashing straight through across the tracks and bumps into all the runners on the outer tracks and crosses and then bumps into the runners or crosses the runner's path on the inner tracks. That would be analogous to this Planet X. Coming straight in, or, you know, essentially it's on a curved path, but that curve is at an angle to the ecliptic. However, if you were to look at it, it's coming straight and crossing over the paths of Earth.
You know, that's interesting because that's exactly how the Abbey Formation shows it. So let's do this. We're at the top of the hour, and I want to give everybody a chance to turn on the key kettle and throw the cat out. And so when we come back, the two things I want to do is, first off, is taking this conversation we've all had, gentlemen, I'd like to just project out, assuming that if, you know, these reports, and we're generally finding that the object is appearing to these folks to the left of the sun and anywhere from around the 9 o'clock to the 11 o'clock position on the sun. All right. And it looks bigger than Jupiter, that's for sure. But let's do this. When we come back, let's take that as an assumption. And if that is what it is, then we should be able to say, okay, if that is the case now in this month, what about November, December, January, February, March, April, May, as we go on? And to see if this is something where we're going to start seeing more of it, or is it something where we start seeing less of it? Let's do that. And then the one thing that we're seeing right now that's really got us all a little concerned, and that's what's happening in the Canary Islands with La Palma. So hang with me, guys. And we're going to take a little break with Peggy Lee singing Riders in the Sky. I thought that would be appropriate for Two Suns in the Sky. And, well, Peggy is, you know, for guys like me, I mean, she's cool. So here we are, Riders in the Sky.
Cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw plowing through the ragged sky and up a cloudy draw. Black and shiny, and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky, for he saw the riders coming hard, and he heard their mournful cry. he heard one call his name. If you want to save your soul from hell of riding on our reins, then cowboy, change your ways today, or with us you will ride, a trying to catch the devil's herd across these endless skies.
And that was Peggy Lee singing Riders in the Sky. Yeah, I grew up with that Peggy Lee music, and I just love it. I mean, that just is, that was, you know, all the other Peggy Lee songs, it was like, well, that's for the old folks when we were kids, showing my age. But, she's got that sweet, sexy voice. So what we're going to do now is I'm going to be bringing Bill and John back in here, and we're going to do a projection here, looking forward from this point in time out until the first part of December 2012, and with two sun sightings, if Planet X, all right, is being observed just momentarily from time to time, just because it kind of sneaks out from behind the wobble. All right, but it is going to arc over the sun. So with that, let's project out to November. What do you guys say? I'll start with John.
You know, I just came back from the bathroom. Now, I assume you're talking about in November, this second object. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. If you want, we'll start off. You're coming up to speed on this, so let me throw it first to Bill, then we'll come back to you.
Okay.
Bill, what do you think?
What we're going to be seeing in November, you think, of this
yeah.
year or next
November,
year?
November of this year. Take me into November and then December, January. What would you, assuming that that's the object that people are reporting in their two sons' videos out to the left of the sun, but close to it, very close to it. What do you think we're going to be seeing in the months ahead? Assuming that is a genuine object and that we're not all having a bad case of delusion.
I'm picturing the Earth's orbit around the sun right now in mm-hmm. the direction that we're moving in and the direction that we're seeing this. And I would think that given the direction that we move in, I would almost think that the thing was going to go back behind the sun and come out on the other side, if I'm picturing the orbital dynamics correctly. And from that point, it's going to move farther and farther away from the sun. Now, if it's moving, if it's going to come out at, say, the 4 o'clock position as we go around the sun, then we're not going to see it after the sun goes down because it's going to be below the sun.
Well, we'll see it. What Abe Barry shows is that we see it in the northern hemisphere, and it'll be, when we do see it, we'll see it at its point of perihelion, its closest point to the sun. And this is just where it starts arcing back to its trip, leaving the core of the system back out to the edge of the system. And that will be, if you're looking at the sun, just go 45 degrees to your right, 45 degrees up, and there's where you see it. So at its point of perihelion, it's already dipping down, so it'll have like the hump of a camel, kind of, if you think of it, coming across the top. So do you think that we would see at some point that, given that span of time, that we'll start seeing these things? Yeah, in other words, November, December, maybe January. In other words, in the next few months, it's going to disappear again back behind the sun as it's climbing up. But then we'll start getting reports of it where people are going to start observing it, say, sometime next year. And instead of it being in the you know, a lot of the stuff that we're seeing with the genuine reports, not the disinfo garbage, it's all over the map on disinfo garbage, but on the genuine reports, what I'm seeing is people are showing me stuff that's in the upper left-hand quadrant. Now, the question is, when does it go to the upper right-hand quadrant? So, John, if you've been following me on all that, what's your guesstimate for that?
Wow, I mean, there's so many intangibles. It's
Well, you're the guy that can balance the oranges.
I think...
Go, John, go!
This situation that is so unfamiliar to we who live on Earth, because it's out in space, it's totally foreign. We always have to draw these vivid pictures. And like right now, I'm thinking of a circular revolving table at a restaurant. And in the center of the table, you have a bright lamp that represents the sun. And, of course, at various points on the table, we place various objects to represent the planets, like a grapefruit far out would be Jupiter, and a walnut closer to the center would be Earth, and so on. So if you can visualize that, then visualize this, someone shooting a ball bearing from the floor, but off to the side, shooting this huge ball bearing, which represents Planet X, but it's traveling in slow motion now. And it's going up underneath the table, closer to the table. It's coming up at an angle. And Dr. Harrington, the former chief astronomer of the U.S. Naval Observatory, calculated that this object was coming at a 40-degree angle to the ecliptic. The revolving table represents the ecliptic plane. So let's assume that he was pretty close. 40-degree angle is would be the trajectory, the path of this ball bearing coming up close to the underside of the table. But it's going to go sort of out far out near the edge of the table and then penetrate the table and then loop through the table and come up over the lamp. That's the situation we're dealing with right now. If anybody's seeing, you know, we're making an assumption, which we can't even prove yet, that this object, the second sun, we don't even know if it's a real object to begin with. But let's assuming,
if you want me to assume that it's a real object
and it's Planet X, then we could try to take it from there. But then again, it's based on a shaky, you know, not solid foundation of information. But we could still hypothesize on it if you like.
Well, John, I live in a world of shake, okay? So don't worry about that.
You want to assume that this is Planet X?
Well, if we're
assuming... And we're seeing the real thing.
And let's say there's a possibility that it could be the real thing, but let's just say that just simply on the basis that once I started seeing these two sun observations to the left of the sun between the 9 and 11 o'clock positions, or the 9 and the 12 o'clock positions, the upper left-hand quadrant, what I started noticing is that the people that are making those observations are emotionally affected, which tells me that they have experienced something. What they have experienced, you don't know. This is like MUFON. You know, somebody says they saw a UFO, they saw something. And it leaves a lasting impression on them. But trying to get the evidence together to say, well, yeah, you had a genuine, authentic experience, that's hard to say. But, I mean, okay. MUFON, you know, MUFON's not going to, you know, fork up the cost of a plane ticket for somebody that's a flake.
Right.
They're going to go at people that are just, you know, they talk to him and he's just genuine. These people have seen and experienced something. You try to get to the bottom of it. All too often, you just can't get enough information to make a hard call.
Okay, then let's say that this object is a huge comet, and it could be Planet X, or it could be something very large that Planet X is dragging along with it. It could be the Vanguard object, the Blue Kachina. Mm-hmm. Or Planet X itself. Okay, and because of its size, we don't really care. We know it's going to cause traumatic effects on planet Earth.
Big bada bing.
Right. So this ball bearing has now penetrated the table far out, probably near that grapefruit Jupiter, way out near the edge of the table, maybe even further out where the gas giants are, Uranus and Neptune.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's beginning to penetrate the table. Now, if it's Planet X, and it could very well be, or something very large and something of great consequence, you're going to see effects with the jet stream, and I'm seeing them. I follow the Weather Channel every day, and I see this dynamic change. I try to make a mental recording in my mind of the day-by-day changes in the jet stream as depicted on the Weather Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing the tremendous changes over a rather short period of time in the last year, which is relatively short. Since I've been watching it, I've been watching this Weather Channel since 2004.
Mm-hmm.
In the last year, these undulations in the jet stream have really become very convoluted, extremely convoluted. It used to be like a W. You know, back from 2004 to 2009, it was pretty consistently bizarre. It was bizarre,
yeah,
but consistently bizarre. It looked like a huge W with the peak of the W extending up to the U.S.-Canadian border and the trough of the W down around Arizona, Texas, and the W would slide slowly over a period of a few days from west to east. So the trough would go from Arizona, Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, etc. Now that W, and then, well, I'd say back around late 2009, early 2010, that W got extremely large, such that it extended all the way up. The peak of the W was up to around Alaska, and the trough of the W was down deep in the Caribbean, way down near the northeast shoulder of Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
And then the W would stretch all the way across the Atlantic to Great Britain. So it mm-hmm. was an extreme change that we saw occurring from the normally bizarre condition that had persisted from 2004 to 2009. So now what I'm seeing is an even more bizarre change. No longer is it a huge W. It looks like a teardrop. Can you visualize that? Like a
yeah.
line that's going way up into Canada. That's why we're getting all this hot weather now, even in the northern states, because this line of the jet stream goes way up into above the Canadian border, the U.S.-Canadian border. But yet there's a teardrop of the trough that comes down, straight down, very sharp, like a spike almost. Comes all the way down into Mexico. So this
mm-hmm.
is really worrisome, extremely worrisome. And we're getting the most severe weather you can imagine, because when that front, that jet stream front, becomes vertical, you get tremendous clash of warm, moist air being sucked up from the Gulf of Mexico, clashing with this cold air that lies from, well, this cold Canadian air that is trapped and pulled down within that teardrop. So you get hot and cold clashing. It's like pouring cold water into a scorching, red-hot frying pan. You
mm-hmm.
get tremendous reaction, whether, you know, tornadoes and everything. Well, in addition to that, beside this teardrop, you're seeing this huge O, which is a big high, or could be a cut. They're now calling it a cutoff high, and
mm-hmm.
sometimes it's a cutoff low. Well, we've never had this. I've never, ever seen that in the 7 years from 2004 to 2009. Well, I'll try to, you know, finish with that analysis and tell you that I'm surmising from this drastic change in the jet stream that Planet X has now come into the ecliptic, and that ball bearing I was describing is now penetrating that circular table way out there near Jupiter, or perhaps even further out. It's beginning to, it's head and shoulders now. This comet, Planet X, or one of its major comrades,
mm-hmm.
is head and shoulders, shoulder to shoulder, with Jupiter and Uranus and Neptune, and
mm-hmm.
it's preparing to go above. But remember now, what has happened to it when it went under the table, when this ball bearing shot under the table upward at an angle toward the underside of the table? As it was approaching the sun, before it got underneath the sun was pulling it, sort of like a fisherman would pull on a fishing line. He's reeling in his big fish. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fish, he pulls it in such that the fish begins to fly over his head on the line. And he's looking up in the air and watching his fish that he's reeling in go flying over his head. Now, what's happening? No longer is he pulling the fish in, but he's pulling back on the fish because the fish is overshooting over his head. It's overshooting him. Now he has to pull backward on that fish to keep it from flying over his head. That's exactly what's happening with the sun. Now, Planet X, if it has indeed gone underneath the sun at that angle, gone underneath that revolving circular table and punctured the outer portion of that circular table near the outer planets, then that means that the sun is no longer pulling it in, but pulling it back. What happens then when the sun pulls it back? It decelerates. It's no longer accelerating from the pulling force, but it's decelerating from the reverse backward pulling force. It's like a man running past you, a man with suspenders, you know, and you're pulling him in. And then as soon as he gets past you, you grab him from the back by his suspenders and you yank him backward. He's decelerating. So that's what's happened. This thing is going to slow down. It has to. I mean, I'm just going by basic physics. Mm-hmm. It has to slow down, which means it's going to, there's your 3.5 years. That explains why you would have 3.5 years, according to the Bible, of great tribulation. And also the ancients talked about this, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't checked the ancient history out that thoroughly, but there's going to be a long period of horrible, slow, painful earth changes.
Yeah. I mean, it's not going to, a lot of folks have an expectation that this is something all of a sudden one day shows up and boom. And that's not it. I mean, this is, it's always been for us a slow motion train wreck. And what we've always maintained was that you're looking at 2013 and 2014 are both going to be bad years. And so it's not until the end of 2014 or even longer that we see some relief from it. So if it's a, you know, total period of time of 3.5 years, and I know that, you know, other Bible scholars have said that this is a something where there's going to be a war ongoing, and then we look up in the sky, we finally look up to Rukh Makto, and we go, ooh, that's it. We got something better to do than a war. And people lay down their arms and go home and try to prepare for something much worse. So, but getting back to real fast, just in a couple of minutes here, with this trajectory, if we're seeing it on and off again now, and I can't say that definitely. I'm saying we have genuine sighting reports. These are honest people, and they're emotionally upset by what they've seen. I can say that. But we cannot say what they have seen because they didn't know how to document it so that other people could follow their work to understand their experience. So they're shooting through a plate glass window, or they have a lot of erratic camera movements, or we find that, you know, there's a problem with the camera. So there's these things that you have to knock it off and say, well, we can't authenticate it.
Right.
But assuming that they're catching a glimpse of something that's out there now,
mm-hmm.
take me to January of next year.
Okay.
Are we now, seeing it over the sun?
I think if we 3 months is going to do a lot to help us understand what this is.
Okay.
Because if this, if it's true that we'll start out with the premise that this thing is on the opposite side, directly opposite side of the sun from us, or pretty close to directly opposite,
mm-hmm.
then in 3 months, we're going to be alongside of it, because now the Earth will have revolved one quarter of the way around, and instead of looking at it in the daytime with the sun blinding us, we're going to be facing the sun again during the daytime. That is 3 months from now, we'll be facing
mm-hmm.
the sun, and this object will no longer be right across from, right in the line of sight of the sun, but it'll be off to our right shoulder. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
3 months from now, I'm looking at the sun during the daytime. I'll look off to my right shoulder, turn my head sideways, and I'll see that object out there. My right shoulder would be sunrise
mm-hmm.
or sunset.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see.
Okay.
It would be would be sunrise.
All right.
Okay, now three months.
At sunrise now.
It is?
Yeah, that's when, well, the reports from China.
China
and
has
Antarctica.
Right.
Okay, yeah, 3 months of sunrise.
Yeah. Okay,
it's all sunrise.
The stuff that we're getting, the stuff that's genuine but we can't authenticate,
you know, so it's, yeah, I mean, the webcams have it. But
it's not in line with the sun. If you're seeing it in the sunrise sky, when the dawn is just beginning to break and the sky is beginning to go from dark to gradually light, and you're seeing it right on the horizon there, it's not in the line of sight with the sun.
Right. It's usually, as I recall in these images that we've seen, it's well below it.
Let me think now. Wait. See if I got this right. The sun is coming up. Yeah, I guess it would be in line with the sun at sunrise. Okay. Yeah, because the sun is basically in the same position. Okay, then 3 months from now, okay, if that's the case, then if we see it at sunrise and it's in line with the sun at sunrise, and 3 months from now, our back will be to this object. And that means we can only see it in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. 3 o'clock in the morning, you get out of bed.
Right.
And you can see it real clearly if you're willing to wake up at 3 o'clock. That's what I'm visualizing anyway. So we'll know in 3 months.
We'll know in 3 months. And what Abe Berry shows is, trust me, in December 2012, you're not gonna have to figure out. All you got to do is just look up. It's going to be there, and it's going to be big, bad, and scary. But in the meantime, we have other issues. And I think that what I'd like to do, because we have a half hour left in the show, is now let's shift gears into the more immediate concern of what's happening on La Palma. Because, you know, when I announced this show, and I held off a little longer than usual, I tend to like to announce shows maybe Wednesday or Thursday of the week prior. But this one, I didn't get up the announcement until yesterday, because I've really been following this, and it's the earthquake activity is on Faro, not on La Palma itself. But La Palma is in that archipelago of islands in the Canary Islands, and it's the sister island that's due north of it. And so, you know, what we are seeing is vast swarms of small quakes, the tremblers. It's just stunning how much they've had in the last few months. And then they had a pretty good one that hit just a day or so ago. So with that, let's turn our attention towards La Palma. And where are you at with this thing, John? What do you see as the main concerns?
Earthquake swarms are a precursor to volcanic eruption. Earthquakes around a volcanic site are precursors to an eruption, and we are seeing a really incredible number of earthquake swarms. I mean, earthquakes among these swarms, clusters of tiny earthquakes are called swarms.
Thousands and thousands.
Yeah, like nearly 10,000 are reported by the people there on the islands, by the geological service there, that nearly 10,000 in less than 2 months, and it's getting so frightening that they're evacuating people from that island El Hierro and evacuating them to the opposite side of the island because just this morning or yesterday there was an undersea volcanic eruption for the first time just south in the ocean, right off of the coast, the southern coast of El Hierro, the island, that has been experiencing all of those earthquake swarms. So we're seeing the logical results of these earthquake swarms. And as this comet, again, we have to connect Illinen and other big, massive bodies with the disasters that are building on Earth right now. Mm-hmm. We have to connect them. So we see Illinen coming in, and we're going to see its closest approach coming very soon. This is very worrisome, because this could mean a more serious eruption from that undersea volcano just south of El Hierro, and possibly an eruption from the feared Cumbre Vieja volcanic mountain, which will all the geologists tell us, because it's dislocated from the mountain proper, its entire western flank will slide into the ocean and cause the total destruction of the entire east coast of the Americas. But because it will create a landslide-driven tsunami, which the geologists tell us is about 10 times greater in amplitude than the typical undersea earthquake-driven tsunami that we saw several years ago.
Right. Do you know, seismically, is there a connection between these two islands? Are they on the same fault line?
I don't know. I haven't looked at that. I'm not sure. But there's a good chance that they are, because they're really relatively close to one another.
Right.
And faults are usually pretty long, you know, and if there is a fault, I would just surmise that it's the same fault line.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, what they're telling us is that this western flank weighs 500 billion tons, a half a trillion tons of rock. It's like a brick on the top of a sliding board. And the only thing, it's not, there's still a frictional force of this dislocated western flank against, you know, holding it to the mountain proper. But once the water that's trapped in that margin separating that crack, that space separating the mountain proper from the western flank, once that water is heated up and becomes steam, then the frictional forces between the two masses, the mountain proper and the western flank, will, the frictional forces will greatly diminish, and it'll slide like a brick down a well-greased sliding board.
You know, it's interesting with this seismicity. I was watching NOVA did an excellent report on the quake in Japan, the tsunami, the one that's triggered the Fukushima. And what they were explaining was that normally there shouldn't have been such a high wave, but there was all the sediment that was above the fault line, the subduction line. And so when it went, there was a 1-2 punch. You had a normal tsunami, which should have been a much smaller wave hitting, which they say that GE plant could have sustained that. But what really caused the high wave that did the really heavy damage, and it was in four different areas where it triggered off, was that when the fault slipped, that there was all of this built-up silt and mud on top of it. It did the same thing. And then it was a 1-2 punch that created this one single super spike tsunami wave, which is the one that did all the heavy damage. You know, so I think that if there's one thing Fukushima really proved to us, is that there's a tremendous amount about the geology of the seabed we do not understand. And that we're learning the hard way. We're learning very expensively. So when I have seen people poo-pooing this La Palma threat and saying, well, if it does, it's not going to be so dramatic. It's going to be a small wave. It's not going to be all this high.
Well, anybody who says that is speaking out of ignorance, because the leading geologist in that area, on that particular subject of La Palma, that is Dr. Simon Day and Dr. Bill McGuire of the University College London. They've been stationed there. They've been doing extensive research and studies there for years, and they are highly alarmed and trying to sound the warning that this thing is going to be, it's going to kill many millions of people along the coast of the Americas, and they're trying to warn people. And here's what I think we need to do. I put out a long essay about back in 2005 about the La Palma threat and what we could do about it. The first thing is we have to get a whole body of people, many volunteers, come out of the grandstands and get onto the playing field, because many lives are at risk right now. Maybe in a day or two or 3 days, who knows when, if that thing ever goes and causes that tsunami. We need to, many of us, identify emergency medical personnel who reside in towns, who work in towns right along the Atlantic shore. People, EMT personnel and firemen, these are rescue types of people. That's their job, is to rescue those people in dire need. EMT and firemen from Atlantic City, Miami, all the coastal towns, Norfolk, Virginia, Asbury Park, New Jersey, you name it, any town that's along the coast. Why would that be? Why would we do that? Well, because we're very limited in the number of people we can reach. But you want to get the ones who would be most fearful and most concerned, because their lives are directly in danger. If that tsunami hits, they're dead. They and their family are dead, and all their townsfolk are dead. If they happen to be emergency medical personnel in Atlantic City, for example. So these are the people we need to reach, but we need a whole cadre of volunteers. Finding them on the internet, EMT groups, chat groups, Yahoo groups, whatever, and firemen's associations, and reaching those particular people with this warning that when you see, we have to monitor that volcano on the Cumbre Vieja, and when it begins to smoke, smolder, and steam, pack up, have a bag packed, get ready to jump in your car, and drive inland. Even if it doesn't erupt, you don't know when. You may be taking several day trips unnecessarily, but you might enjoy them anyway. Call in sick, take a vacation day. Save your vacation days for these types of emergencies, because it could save your life. If you wait until the last minute, what will definitely happen is that thousands of people will die in their cars in gridlock while the highways are inundated with the tidal wave. Mm-hmm. People will just die on gridlocked highways if we don't do
John,
this.
I have a question.
Yeah.
How much of a warning are we going to get? The Canary Islands are close to Africa. Now, if this
very
thing slides off and the tsunami starts, do we have the tsunami warning system in the Atlantic Ocean that we have in the Pacific Ocean? And how much of a warning are people going to get?
Very, very little. Dr. Simon Day and Dr. Bill McGuire, as well as the scientists at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland, tell us that this thing will travel across the ocean from off the west coast of Africa to strike the east coast of the Americas. It'll take about 8 hours to make that trip across the Atlantic Ocean. It'll be traveling at about 450 miles an hour. The first plop, when this western flank slides into the Atlantic, the first plop they estimate from experimentation is that it will be two Empire State Buildings high. But of course it'll level off, as you know, tsunami waves do in a deep ocean. But when this huge volume of moving water reaches the shallow shores, because there's not that much depth, all that volume has to rear up in a very high tidal wave. So it'll take 8 hours. Their buoy system is inadequate. I mean, you'll get a buoy warning, but if it happens at 3 o'clock in the morning, I don't think people are going to even alert the public about it. I mean, the people will be caught in their beds asleep when this thing hits.
That's my concern, that this is something that trips off, you know, and time is, you know, it's not on our side. It's not something where, you know, this happens just in time for the evening news. This is something, like you just said, it happens 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, our time. All it needs, and think about it, even if it's just like midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning here, by the time that wave hits, a lot of them are on their way to work.
Right. And the government, of course, think of the government. They don't want the stock market to crash. They don't want the fragile House of Cards economy to collapse. So they're not going to warn anybody. We're on our own. The government, in fact, at this point, is our stumbling block. And so what we have to do is do it on our own. We have to organize a network where we can reach, and thank God for the internet, where we can reach many people who are in the emergency medical and departments and fire relief people, those kind of people who are trained to react, trained for emergency situations. And there may be other categories of workers that I haven't even mentioned that you people can think of. But we need to start contacting them and say, well, this is what we're going to do. We have to watch this volcano and see when it begins to smoke and smolder and steam. They don't know. They have no idea that this thing exists. They have no idea that this danger is awaiting us. Could be in a couple of days, especially with all this comet coming by, this comet causing Earth traumas. Now, oh, I got to tell you something else. This is amazing. I sent you an email, Marshall. We got confirmation of my theory that I had published on the internet as widely as I possibly could last year in regard to the real explanation as to what happened with the Gulf of Mexico. What caused that Gulf of Mexico so-called oil spill? And now we have confirmation that it's true, and the confirmation comes from scientists who are surrounding and have been studying the Gulf of Mexico for the past year or so. They are saying what I said back then, and the only reason I knew it was because I had advanced knowledge about Planet X, as you do, Marshall. And I also had a friend who told me that he has a friend. This was 5 years ago. Imagine this, 5 years ago, long before anybody ever heard of BP or a Gulf of Mexico oil spill. 5 years ago, my friend told me that his USGS, U.S. Geological Survey geologist friend told him that they expect land masses to arise out of the Gulf of Mexico. I heard this 5 years ago. And, of course, I knew it was because of Planet X. But then when I saw the BP oil spill, I said, uh-oh. This is a consequence. This is the beginning of the buckling and bulging of the Gulf of Mexico seabed that this geologist was predicting. And this whole BP oil spill was a big lie. They may have been drilling to relieve the pressure. I heard some information to that effect. But also, it could have been that they had oil wells there, and every country was there reaping the benefits. This was another prediction, another fact that was told to me 5 years ago by the same friend of the geologist. He said two things are going to happen. This was 5 years ago. The Gulf of Mexico seabed floor will begin to rise, and islands will emerge from the Gulf of Mexico. Secondly, there's all kinds of fantastic, fabulous oil drilling opportunities now beginning to emerge. This was 5 years ago, and sure enough, every nation was in there drilling. But when this oil spill happened, what happened? If there was just an oil spill, why would every oil company from every nation that it was reaping the drilling in there, in that Gulf, why would they all flee like cockroaches when the lights are turned on? Why would they scoot out of there so fast if it was just one BP oil spill? Because the whole seafloor is beginning to break up. Nobody told them to get out of there. I mean, that's what I read anyway, that they were picking up and packing up and getting out of there.
Bugging out. But, you know, we've reported, I think back in 2008, 2009, we were seeing sonar buoys that in the South Pacific that were rising up, and the dramatic seabed rises.
And you confirmed that too. It's more than just rumor, right, Marshall?
Right, we confirmed. No, we published the data. What happened was we published the data as much as we could get before they all of a sudden said we have three buoys that have suddenly malfunctioned,
right,
and they're not working. It's another one of those manipulation coinkadinks. But the data on those buoys before they flagged them as inoperative, as it was dramatic. I mean, the seabed in some places, 50 meter rise in the seabed. Think about that, 50 meters.
Wow. Well, you know, you were the only one who actually documented those buoy readings.
Yeah.
Every other article was just a report, but it was not confirmed. But you actually got the data, the buoy data, and published it. So that was good. That
yeah.
At least we proved it to be true. And now, because of that proof, we can safely say that indeed the seabeds around the world are beginning to buckle. Now, imagine this. This is something that
I'm... And, you know, that's exactly what... When we, you know, Edgar Cayce said that. That
wow.
is what we're going to see. We're going to see land masses rising. You know, land masses falling, land masses are rising. These things are going to happen. So,
and what did de Colbrun say? De Colbrun says it in ages past, and I'm sorry for the interruption. I'll get back to you. I'll
please,
let you speak
please.
In just a second. But in de Colbrun, I'm going to paraphrase. It says, these are the ancients speaking now of what they saw in the past. They say, people forget the days of the destroyer and that it will come again at its appointed time.
Right.
In ages past, the earth, normally the stars travel in a predictable way, and they move in a predictable way, and everything is regular and periodic. However, when the destroyer comes in, the stars begin to be chaotic, and they move in the sky. Well, of course they're chaotic because the earth is beginning to wobble. It's not the stars that are wobbling.
That's right. That's right. And what does Nostradamus say? The planets run riot.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's all confirmed between these.
It all, yeah.
The ancient texts, the ancient witnesses, and the prophets, the psychics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the thing that is, and over the years, I mean, John, it is just, my jaw keeps hitting the table. Time and time again, I see where we have these direct correlations. And I mean, it's like, excuse me, you know, what did Nostradamus know of the Colbrun? It was in hiding at the time he was alive, and it was up in Scotland somewhere, buried in secret society, wasn't publishing it. But you had all of these other things that were happening. And with this, I mean, what does Mother Shipton say? That, you know, the seas are just going to, Gabriel's going to sound his horn. The seas are going to go crazy. Well, if you have land masses rising up from the seabed, yeah, I think that would kind of get Gabriel blowing his horn. What do you think?
Right. And you know, in that Colbrun quotation, the sun, the stars begin to swirl around in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that when blood drops upon the earth, this is from the ancients now, when blood drops upon the earth, that's like flaming rocks and meteorites, when blood drops upon the earth, the mountains will open up and belch forth fire and smoke.
Mm-hmm.
Seas will boil. The seas will be swallowed up by the land, and the seas will boil. Well, that's a vision of land masses thrusting upward from the seabeds and becoming land islands, thrusting upward, and everything gets so hot because of the magma that's erupting from beneath the crust of the earth, beneath the seabed, that the sea will actually boil. And this is what the ancients tell us, that the land masses will be thrust up and the seas will boil. So we can expect that to happen now. All we can do is play dodgeball and do our best at it. Dodge that ball. The next ball coming at us is that tsunami. We have to say, oh, it may not hit us. No, it's not a matter. This is what the best geologists in the world stationed out there in the Canary Islands are saying. They're saying it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And now it's turning out that when is soon. Change when to soon, very soon.
Yeah. And I think the thing that saddens me about La Palma is that they've had plenty of time. I mean, the geologists were saying, look, if we take and drill pier foundations into the side of this thing, all right, it may not stop it from the flank collapsing, but it would be a crumbling collapse. In other words, it would dramatically mitigate any real damage that it could do. Whereas right now, it's just, you've got this god-awful amount of rock and dirt sitting there that could just do boom. a dramatic slide right in.
And now it's too late to mitigate it.
Now it's too late. Now it's too late. And so, you know, people out on the West Coast, and, I got to tell you, I've been talking with folks that, you know, they're people that you know, and here's the hard part, and is you're seeing this, I'm seeing this, I'm sure a lot of the listeners out there, they see it, and you want to say to folks that you know living on the East Coast, pay attention, and what you get back from them is, you're doom and gloomer.
But you know, Marshall, we focus on those people who are trained for emergencies. I think that's our best hope. Just the EMT personnel and maybe emergency hospital personnel and firemen and even police. And mm-hmm. let them know that, you know, even I spoke to a policeman in my town, and he didn't think, when I told him about Planet X and all the Earth changes, he was very attentive and basically nodding his head in agreement. And he was asking me for more information. So this indicates to me that the police have been told, not necessarily that Planet X is causing it, but they've been warned that we're going to see major meteorological and geological disasters that they're going to have to cope with. So if we alert the police, we need a cadre of people, who volunteers who are going to find only those who are right on the shore, the Atlantic shore, Atlantic mm-hmm. City, Boston, you name it, Norfolk, Virginia, Miami Beach, Daytona Beach, West Palm Beach, all those people, and just focus in on them and tell them that we've got to monitor this volcano. When it begins to steam, don't wait for it to slide into the sea, but be proactive. Get on that mm-hmm. Florida highway, because you can only go north and south. You have to. There's not much of a way to get out of Florida. You need a couple of days to beat the gridlock traffic.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. And it's like, I think your idea of talking to first responders is really intelligent. I will tell you what I have seen over the years with first responders. And they do give me information that corroborates everything you're saying about the preparations. I think one that really stood out in my mind is one man who's a retired sheriff, but still very active in his town. And he ran his own department. And one of the things that happened he thought was really odd, he said that they had always been using, the EMP, Toshiba makes the Tough Book, I think. And the police really like using the Tough Books. They take them out there, and it's a laptop that's shock mounted, and it's, you know, really designed to take a beating and keep on ticking. But what happened was that he said all of their Tough Books, which he said, we loved them. We didn't have any problem with them. Department of Homeland Security went into his department and pulled them all, and replaced them with new laptops. And he said these new laptops weigh twice as much, and they're super hardened for EMP. They're mil-spec. So it's basically, you got a Faraday cage sitting in this thing that could withstand a nuclear attack. And I thought that was pretty interesting. But usually what happens with the first responders, I mean, they get into it and it starts to connect with people and things that they're seeing. The dots start going click, click, click. And they usually have information that we don't have in terms of what's happening out there with planning and preparations. Like there are companies that specialize in making survival canned goods. One company makes tinned butter. And what was stunning was that, like, you know, a six-month supply of tinned butter that they had, you know, in their stockpile. The government came in and bought everything, literally wiped off the shelves. And they're doing this even more and more. I mean, there's a lot of this material, particularly preserved food, that the government is stockpiling and setting aside. But with the first responders, one thing you got to be ready for is they're going to talk, and they're going to want to understand, they're going to want to know more, and then they're going to get quiet and go away. And it's not because they're thinking you're an idiot or they went down a rabbit hole. They they go away because they're told to go away. You know, I call it the phone rings. And so with contacting first responders, you might have one or two conversations, but once it starts going, you know, once they take this information beyond their scope, and they start networking, going out and talking to other people, that's when someone's going to pick up the phone, call them and say, shut up.
I think we have to take that chance. We can reach them on the various chat groups that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're together, networking together, people are a lot more courageous and proactive than if they're all alone and receiving this information. So we can reach them on the internet, I think, in groups. We have to take the chance. We have no other alternative if we don't tell people. And, well, I mean, if we told the general public, there are just too many people to reach.
And very few of them
would listen, and most of them would die in the inundation.
Right.
If thing strikes.
We've got a couple of minutes left here in the show, John, and we do have a couple of good souls out there in the virtual chat room, and they are listening, and they have got a couple of quick questions for us. I'm going to throw them at you. The first one comes from Lori Corbett Jeffries. Susan, can you ask them how far inland it will go? Will Atlanta be hit? And, of course, I'm talking. Susan is our moderator out there in the chat room. And y'all have been kind of quiet out there, so you haven't had Susan working as hard as she normally does. Not that I think Susan's going to complain, but there's that question from Lori, which is, how far inland will it go? Will Atlanta be hit?
Well, it depends on the altitudes along the way from the coast to that inland distance limit. It depends on the various hills and topographical structure of the land along the way. That's one variable. But let's say we just average out the land and say it's sort of flat and maybe 100 feet, some average height above sea level.
Right.
According to Dr. Simon Day, it'll go as far as 20 kilometers inland. We have to base that on his average altitude above sea level. Now, how far in miles is 20 kilometers, do you know?
Well, I mean, that's nowhere near Atlanta, so I think Atlanta will be fine with that. But we have another one, because we're losing time here.
Oh, okay.
We have Roly Poly says, I'm in North Carolina. Some prep friends have said we need to be about 600 miles inland and 200 plus up in the mountains, like they think the Appalachian Mountains will be safe. What I can say is that if you are in North Carolina, I've been up there. Actually, I have hiked up there. I was with a friend. We were hiking around and looking at their stunning waterfalls up there. Oh, golly gee, at the south end of the Appalachians. That's a good area, Roly-Poly. That is a good area. Boy, if I were in your neck of the world, that's where I would want to be, is around the Appalachians. And, John, I think we're just pretty much out of time here. Man, this has just been a heck of a show. Just one last question, real fast. What do you think, if La Palma is going to pop, how many weeks or months before it pops?
Well, I see a comet coming. We see it. This comet is coming. Going to reach its closest approach to Earth in, 2 weeks,
okay,
something like that. I think that's what Ed said.
So if it's going
to
go...
That's what I think the great danger is. It's hard to say if La Palma will actually slide into the ocean when this comet passes by. It depends on how much effect it has on Earth's crust and on the heating up of the magma and the resultant volcano that may occur.
John, there's our music. We lost it. We're just out of time. Definitely appreciate it. Another fabulous show.